And that is the official start sound for Coffee with the Coder for Monday, November the 6th, 2017. This is episode 24. We are eager to get into the questions and answers this morning. Thank you for dialing in and for telling your colleagues to dial in and for submitting those questions, because we'd love to get those questions. I'm ready to toss out the first one, Paula. This one was submitted anonymously, which, of course, you're welcome to do. I should tell you that we love the anonymous questions, and we even love the other ones with your names on them, because somebody is going to win an official Coffee with the Coder mug today. And that will be somebody who asked a question non-anonymously, so you didn't mind giving us at least your first name and how to reach out to you in case you're the winner. So this one is an anonymous submission, and it says Pro-Fee. Medicare payment guidelines for physician services build on professional claims for a member whose home is an assisted living facility. And the person says, I understand that per Medicare billing guidelines, a physician is required to bill place of service 13 when seeing a member in an assisted living, ALF, since that is where services were rendered to the member. Are there any guidelines specific to a Medicare Advantage payer supporting Medicare coverage of physician services in place of service 13? And are they equivalent with the processing rules of similar services rendered in a home setting?
Okay, well, thank you for that question. In order to determine, now, first of all, let me back up a second. Anything that Medicare I'll call it Medicare proper, anything that they cover, the Medicare Advantage is also required to cover. Now, they can not cover something if they deem it is not medically necessary. So, but in order to determine specifics that are outside of your Medicare original guidelines, you would need to look at your contract language with that particular Medicare Advantage payer. So, however, it's important to state to you that guidelines for filling out the claim forms, whether it's UB04, whether it's the 1500 claim form, guidelines for filling out those forms are not specific to payer. They are universal guidelines for filling out those forms. There is time, or there are times, that you might see a payer will require a certain element that other payers don't require, but generally, overall, the way that you fill out those forms is universal. So I would say get out those contracts if it is something, because the question was not, does Medicare cover this? But if you want to know that information, then we can dig a little deeper for you. And if you send in a rebuttal, I guess, to that question and say, hey, but what about this? Then we're happy to follow through and give you a further answer.
Thank you. Okay, so our first entry into the mugging contest for today is Janet. And Janet works at an inpatient rehab in Tennessee. Her question is, what is the best practice if the impairment group you place the patient in at admission no longer seems to apply, and she's referenced encephalopathy?
Okay. The question appears, it appears that the question that you are asking is, and I'm just going to restate this, Janet, if we admit a patient and then the focus of care changes, how should that be reported? So for the IRFPAI, that's the IRFPAI, for those of you who are on the line who are not familiar with inpatient rehab facilities, the IGC and the etiologic diagnosis that is the underlying reason for the admission is reported. And if the focus of care changes during that admission, the discharge IGC would be the new focus of care. However, there's a couple of caveats to that. So when payment is being determined, CMS is going to determine payment based on that admission impairment group, and that admission, the impairment group is what sets the payment. The etiologic just supports that. However, another caveat actually is, let's say the patient was admitted to inpatient rehab, and the pre-admission screen said, oh, the patient is here for a hip fracture. And then within 24 hours, maybe before the physician actually got to his or her post-admission physician evaluation, say the patient had a stroke, and it was a post-operative stroke because they repaired this hip fracture with the surgery. And, oh, my goodness, the deficits became pretty significant, but it didn't require maybe it just required a quick sending the patient back over to acute, and then they were readmitted back before 3 days, three calendar days. So the focus of care then became more the stroke, with the hip being a secondary condition or a comorbidity. So in that case, if it happened prior to the physician doing his or her post-admission physician evaluation, in which if he disagreed with the reason on the pre-admission screen, then he would need to say, the patient is admitted for this reason, I disagree with the pre-admission screen, and he would put it in his post-admission physician evaluation. In that case, the impairment group and the etiologic diagnosis would line up with what the physician validated as their reason. So I think I rambled a little bit, Pam, but hopefully you kind of got the gist of that. The only other thing is, on the UB04 claim form, I always like to speak to that, the condition for the reason for admission would be reported on that claim form just as it would have in the past. And then any secondary condition arising would then be reported as a comorbidity. But again, the definition for the principal diagnosis on the UB04 is different than the etiologic diagnosis on the IRF-PI, so different rules apply there.
Thank you. I always love all that level of detail. That just is fascinating for me. Let's hop into the next question. I think we have time for one more. This one is from Anonymous. It's an ICD-10 question, so I don't have the setting. Is it correct to code G, as in GO, 95.9, disease of spinal cord unspecified, when the physician documents cervical myelopathy, or would M, as in Michael, 50.00, cervical disc disorder with myelopathy, unspecified cervical lesion, be more appropriate?
Well, unfortunately, as coders, we cannot presume that the cervical myelopathy is due to a disc disorder unless the physician validates that in the documentation. So therefore, the only option we have is to report that unspecified myelopathy code. There really is not a code for unspecified cervical myelopathy, only unspecified cervical myelopathy that is due to another condition, which, Pam, I think if we can squeeze it in, let's go to that last question, because it kind of bounces off of this question with the spinal conditions.
Excellent. Okay, well, then now we'll have time for two people to be in the drawing for today, okay? And this one is Susan in Oklahoma. She's also in an inpatient rehab. Her question is, when is it appropriate to assign a patient to non-traumatic spinal cord dysfunction?
Okay, I'm going to refer you guys to, Susan, to Section 6 of the IRF-PI manual. And for me, I'm going to pull out my handy-dandy little IRF-PI manual resource tool, that 700-page document that or book that Pam was talking about. And then the first question that you need to ask is there truly cord damage that caused the residuals? And when you're asking the physician to document this, if he or she says something like spinal stenosis, of course you need to query that underlying cause. When I look in my resource tool, I very quickly can see that diagnoses such as neoplasms, spinal abscesses, spinal artery compressions, even aortic aneurysms, spondylosis or disc disorders with myelopathy, they're just a few of the conditions that can cause a cord deficit. But if the physician does not verify the underlying cause, I may not be able to achieve that 60% presumptive eligibility. So it's not just about the diagnosis code that brings you in that says, okay, just because this patient has this diagnosis and the Section 6 of the IRF-PI manual says this diagnosis is used for this impairment group, you also have to look at the deficits. What are the deficits that this patient has? So, to prove that there's cord involvement. So, for example, if I'm going to report an impairment group that has cord involvement, I would pretty well expect to see a diagnosis with a myelopathy involved, even as a comorbidity if it's not the etiologic. I want the underlying reason for the admission rather than the spinal stenosis. I want it was caused by a cervical disc disorder or a lumbar disc disorder or a thoracic disc disorder or, you know, some type of neoplasm or whatever else is associated, because if that's not there, then I lose all ability. I also want to see things like, you know, were there bowel and bladder function defects? Were there, upper extremity, lower extremity weakness? You can't just look at does the patient have weakness, because every patient that comes into rehab has weakness, and that weakness has to be qualified in order to put that patient in a spinal category, meaning there's central cord damage, not just peripheral damage. So, Pam, that was it. I just wanted to get that one in because it kind of bounced off of that last question with the diagnosis.
It did.
Yeah, I don't know if that was a person from an inpatient rehab facility or a hospital that asked that question, but thank you guys for your questions.
Yes, we're eager to get more. Well, since we have two non-anonymous questioners today, I have put their names on opposite sides of a piece of paper, which I've been twirling around under my desk, so we're going to see who's the winner today. And that would be Janet. Congratulations, Janet. I'll be reaching out to you when we're finished in just a moment to find out where to mail your Coffee with Dakota official mug. And we'll be looking for your mug shot. That will be a photograph, a selfie of you and your mug, or you and something with AQ-IQ.com branded on the back. So thanks so much for joining us for this episode. The next episode will be in 2 weeks, and we will have this one posted before you go home today. Join us again in 2 weeks on November the 20th for episode 25. Thank you.